gate and doors of the villa from Signor Rondinelli, who enjoyed free access to Il Gioiello, or from La Piera, the housekeeper, who would have opened any door to his familiar face, he being, as Cecilia's brother, practically a member of the family. But only Suor Maria Celeste could help him unlock the trove of private papers. Her description of the event shows she did not judge Signor Geri's action inappropriate, nor herself an accomplice to any crime against the Holy Office. Apparently, nothing she or Geri and Aggiunti or Galileo had done in this connection required asking God's forgiveness, or she would have shared her prayer for it here in writing in her customary way. Her confusion about the contradictory outcome of Galileo's affairs in Rome, things appearing to her to have been settled to the satisfaction of both sides, stemmed from letters he sent just before being sentenced. At the end of May, as shown in surviving correspondence with his friends, Galileo fully expected leniency for himself and the saving of face for all concerned, though in the end, nothing had turned out that way. "I do not hope for any relief," Galileo wrote to a former pupil in France after the trial, "and that is because I have committed no crime. I might hope for and obtain pardon if I had erred, for it is to faults that the prince can bring indulgence, whereas against one wrongfully sentenced while he was innocent, it is expedient, in order to put up a show of strict lawfulness, to uphold rigor." Though the sisters of San Matteo had been overjoyed to hail Galileo's happy return to Tuscany from Rome, it soon occurred to them how far away from home Siena really lay. Not just the day's ride over 40 miles of hilly terrain still barred the way of reunion, but the Pope's anger as well. Galileo had not yet been granted permission to return to Arcetri. In fact, Urban might never allow him to go home. "When you were in Rome, sire," Suor Maria Celeste wrote Galileo on July 16th, "I said to myself, if I have the grace of your leaving that place and coming as far as Siena, I will be satisfied, for then I can almost say that you are in your own house. And now I am not content, but find myself longing again to have you here even closer. Be that as it may, blessed be the Lord for having granted us his grace so magnanimously until now. It falls to us to try to be truly grateful for this much, so that he may be the more favorably disposed and compassionately moved to bless us in other ways in the future, as I hope he will do by his mercy." In Rome, Ambassador Nicolini continued to press for Galileo's return to Il Gioiello and notified him of each minuscule development in this campaign as a way of keeping hope alive. "Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, I read the letter you wrote to Signor Geri with particular pleasure and consolation, sire, on account of the things contained in its first paragraph. I will be so bold as to venture on into the third paragraph as well, although it pertains to the purchase of some little house I do not know about, which I have inferred that Signor Geri very much wants Vincenzo to buy, albeit with your help. I certainly would not want to be presumptuous, interfering in matters that do not concern me. Nonetheless, because I care a great deal about whatsoever is of even minimal interest to you, sire, I would implore you and exhort you, assuming you are in a position to be able to do this, to give them, if not the full amount, then some appreciable part of it, not only for love of Vincenzo, but just as much to keep Signor Geri favorably disposed toward you, as he has on past occasions shown great fondness for you, sire, and, from all I have seen, tried to help you in any way he could. Therefore, if, without too much trouble on your part, you could give him some sign of gratitude, I should judge that a deed well done. I know that you yourself can perceive and arrange such matters infinitely better than I, and perhaps I do not even know what I am saying, but well I know how anything I say is dictated by pure love toward you. The servant who was in Rome with you came here yesterday morning, urged to do so by Signor Giulio Nunci. It seemed strange to me not to see letters from you, sire, yet I was appeased by the excuse this same man made, explaining that you had not known whether he would pass this way. Now that you are without a servant, sire, our Geppo, who cannot move freely about here, desires nothing more, if only he were granted permission then to come to you, and I should very much like that too. If your thoughts concur, sire, I could see to sending him well escorted, and I believe Signor Geri can secure him a permit to travel. I also want to know how much straw to buy for the little mule, because La Piera fears she will die of hunger, and the fodder is not good enough for her, as she is a most original animal. since I sent you the list of expenses paid out for your house, we have incurred these others that I give you account of now, besides the money that every month I have made sure was paid to Vincenzo Landucci, for which I keep all the receipts, except the last two payments. For at those times he was, as he continues to be now, locked up in his house with the two little children because the plague killed his wife, whereby truly one may say she is released from her toil and gone to her rest, the poor woman." He sent early to ask me for the 6 scudi for the love of God, saying they were dying of hunger, and as the month was almost at its end, I sent him the money. He promised the receipt when he is beyond suspicion of contagion, and I will endeavor to hold him to that. If nothing else, I will first see to these other disbursements, in the event you are not here to take care of them yourself, sire, which I suspect on account of the excessive heat that is upon us. The lemons that hung in the garden all dropped. The last few remaining ones were sold, and from the 2 lire they brought, I had 3 masses said for you, sire, on my own initiative. I wrote to her ladyship, the ambassadress, as you told me to, and sent the letter to Signor Geri, but I do not have a reply, wherefore I suppose I might be wise to write again, suggesting the possibility that either my letter or hers has gone astray. And here, sending you love with all my heart, I pray our Lord to bless you. From San Mateo, the 24th day of July, 1633. Your most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. Vincenzo had used part of Cecilio's dowry to put the down payment on their Costa San Giorgio house years before. Galileo had also contributed his share then, for he was named as an owner on the deed. The house included a garden, a reservoir, and a courtyard, but its rooms were few. Now the building immediately adjacent to it had come up for sale, presenting an irresistible opportunity to expand the young family's quarters without their having to move. While Galileo considered this proposal, he began to improve his health and outlook by engaging his mind in a new puzzle. Archbishop Piccolomini put him to work on the problem of recasting the giant bell for the cathedral's campanile. Chapter 27 Terrible destruction on the feast of San Lorenzo. Sienese foundrymen had erected the mold for the new tower bell out on the street at the foot of the tall campanile with its many-windowed tiers. The mold consisted of 2 clay parts, one to sculpt the outer bell curve and one the inner, nested and resting upside down inside a huge scaffold. In order to maintain the crucial spacing between the 2 halves, the workers suspended the great weight of the inner mold across the rim of the outer by beams, like a sieve over a teacup. But when they started to pour the molten metal, the mold's inner section mysteriously rose and wrecked the contours of the resulting bell. Much surprise and speculation bruited through the piazza before Galileo offered the correct solution, which he proposed to reveal through a demonstration in the archbishop's home. He called for an exact wooden model of the inner half of the bell mold, and when it arrived, he inverted it and filled it with shot to make it heavy. Then he placed the mold model inside a glass urinal. The chamber pot cradled the bell mold according to the archbishop's description, leaving between the glass and wood a space the thickness of a piastra, a heavy silver coin. Next, Galileo began to pour mercury into the urinal through a hole near the top. As soon as the quicksilver climbed just a short way up the walls of the glass container, it lifted the shot-filled mold model, though the model weighed 20 times as much as the piddling amount of mercury underneath it. Galileo had predicted this effect on the basis of his early experiments with floating bodies, wherein he showed how even a small child might lift a heavy load merely by pouring a little water. The same effect had undermined the casting of the bell, Galileo claimed. The liquefied metal had quickly set the interior mold afloat despite its great weight. On the next attempt, he counseled, the workers must tightly anchor the top handles of the inner mold to the pavement to prevent a recurrence. And thus, the archbishop was pleased to observe, the second time the casting went very well. Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, if my letters, as you told me in one of yours, often reach you coupled in pairs, then I can tell you, not to repeat your exact words, that in this last post your letters arrived, like the Franciscan friars, wearing their wooden clogs, not only yoked together but with a resounding clatter, creating in me a much greater than usual commotion of pleasure and happiness, sire, especially when I learned that my supplication on behalf of Vincenzo and Signor Geri, which I submitted to you, or rather urged upon you, to speak more accurately, has been agreed to and settled so promptly and with even more generosity than I had requested. And consequently, I conclude that my importuning in no way posed a disturbance to your peace, for indeed that possibility had worried me greatly. And now I feel cheered and relieved, and I thank you. As for your return, God knows how much I desire it. Nonetheless, sire, when you considered taking your leave from that city where it has suited you for some time to remain, in a place quite nearby, yet outside your own house, I should deem it better for both your health and your reputation to stay on for several more advantageous weeks where, for now, you inhabit a veritable paradise of delights, especially considering the enchanting conversation of that most illustrious Monsignor Archbishop. Rather than to have to return right away to your hovel, which has truly lamented your long absence, and particularly the wine casks, which, envying the praise you have lavished on the vintages of those other regions, have taken their revenge, for one of them has spoiled its contents, or indeed the wine has contrived to spoil itself, as I have already warned you might happen. And the other would have done the same had it not been prevented by the shrewdness and diligence of Signor Rondinelli, who, by recognizing the malady, has prescribed the remedy, advising and working to bring about the sale of the wine, which has been accomplished through Matteo the merchant to an innkeeper. Just today 2 mule loads are being decanted and sent off, with Signor Rondinelli's assistance. These sales, I believe, must bring in 8 scudi. Any surplus left over after the 2 loads will be bottled for the family and the convent, as we will gladly take this little bit. It seemed imperative to seize such an expedient before the wine sprang any other surprise on us that would have necessitated throwing it away. Signor Rondinelli attributes the whole misfortune to our not having separated the liquid from the sediment in the casks before the onset of the hot weather, something I did not know about, because I am inexperienced in this enterprise. The grapes in the vineyard already looked frightfully scarce before 2 violent hailstorms struck and completed their ruination. A few grapes were gathered in the heat of July before the arrival here of the highwaymen, who, not finding anything else to steal, helped themselves to some apples. On the feast day of San Lorenzo there came a terribly destructive storm that raged all around these parts, with winds so fierce that they wreaked great havoc, and touched your house as well, sire, carrying away quite a large piece of the roof on the side facing Signor Chiellini's property, and also knocking over one of those terracotta flower pots that held an orange tree. The tree is transplanted in the ground for the time being, until we have word from you as to whether you want another pot purchased to hold it. And we reported the roof damage to the Bini family, the now deceased Signor Martellini's in-laws, who promised to have it repaired. The other fruit trees have borne practically nothing, particularly the plums, of which we had not a single specimen. And as for those few pears that were there, they have been harvested by the wind. However, the broad beans gave a very good yield, which, according to La Piera, will amount to 5 stia, less than a bushel, and all of them beautiful. Now we must see to the white beans. It would behoove me to give you an answer concerning your inquiry about whether or not I sit idle, but I am saving that until some time when I cannot sleep, as it is now the 3rd hour of the night. I send you greetings on behalf of everyone I have mentioned, and even more from Dr. Ronconi, who never comes here without pressing me for news of you, sire. May the Lord God bless you. From San Matteo, the 13th day of August, 1633, most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. Even in common parlance, in a Catholic country, any day of the month could be communicated by its religious significance as easily as by its number. Thus Galileo understood the freak storm that rent his roof and toppled an orange tree to have occurred on August 10th, from the mention of San Lorenzo, who met his martyrdom bound to a red-hot gridiron, quipping through this torment that his executioners should turn him over, for he had cooked enough on one side. The stultifying heat of the summer of 1633 oppressed the village of Arcetri. Even Suor Maria Celeste complained about the weather, for the heat always weakened her. Unable to sleep, she said she could barely find the strength to move her pen. This was, of course, an exaggeration, for she wrote her father a minimum of 2 letters each week, answering his call for all the minutiae of home. Occasionally, she gave him news of the convent, too, of how Suor Julia, for example, at age 85, had locked arms with death and won. But she said little of her own unflagging attention to the ailing sisters in the infirmary, or how her omnicompetence positioned her as a likely candidate to become Mother Abbess. She might have been elected the previous December after she had reached the proper age for holding office, but she had been strapped with her father's concerns then on the verge of his forced departure for Rome. Perhaps by the time of the next election in 1635, the other nuns would look to her for the sort of leadership to be expected from one so intelligent and caring. Regarding the 6 sisters, the abbess is strictly bound by herself and through other sisters to inquire with solicitous concern about what their illness requires, both in the way of counsel as also in foods and other necessary things, and so provide tenderly and compassionately according to the possibility of the situation. For all are bound to provide for and serve their 6 sisters as they themselves would wish to be served if struck down by any illness. The Rule of St. Clair, Chapter 8. That summer she also doctored Galileo's servant boy, Geppo, who had spent a few days in the Florence hospital on account of a feverish illness involving his spleen. Although his youth and strength saw him quickly through this crisis, he was discharged with a disgusting-looking skin disease acquired from some fellow patient. Suor Maria Celeste cured it with an ointment of her own preparation. Later on, in the unremitting heat, the servants ran out of flour. But since there was no question of lighting the oven anyway that August, Geppo bought bread for La Piera and himself from the convent store. It cost only 8 quattrini for a large loaf, as Suor Maria Celeste informed Galileo, well in the habit now of keeping his accounts. Despite the heat, Galileo flourished in the favorable emotional climate at Siena. Presently, he resumed work on the book he had been meaning to write for at least 25 years. He had first set down a preliminary treatise on motion while a professor at Pisa, but never published it. Then he laid new experimental groundwork for it during his 2 decades in Padua, where he measured the swinging of pendulums until he could describe their periods by a mathematical law, and where he rolled bronze balls down inclined planes 1,000 ways to derive the rate of acceleration in free fall, in whatever time he could spare between meeting teaching obligations and running a cottage industry in military compasses. Later, as court philosopher at Florence in 1618, with the promise of more leisure for such pursuits, he reopened the labeled folders of his Paduan notes, only to be waylaid first by illness and then by comets. He returned once more to the project early in 1631, while awaiting permission to publish the dialogue. Now, detained at the archbishop's palace, Galileo revisited his ideas about the way everyday objects move, bend, break, and fall. "There is perhaps nothing in nature older than motion," Galileo noted of the humdrum topic for his next book, "about which volumes neither few nor small have been written by philosophers." But all of those earlier texts had concerned themselves with pinning down the cause of motion. Galileo proposed to strike out on a different course, to drop all Aristotelian talk of why things moved, and focus instead on the how, through painstaking observations and measurements. In this fashion, he had discovered and described phenomena that generations of earlier philosophers had not even noticed. For example, the shape of the path traced through space by a hurled or fired missile, Galileo showed, was not just a line somehow curved, as his predecessors had said, but always precisely a parabola. And when lemons dropped from treetops or cannonballs from towers, each one picked up speed in the same characteristic pattern tied to the elapsed time of its fall. Whatever distance the object covered in one instant, measured as a pulse beat, a sung note, the weight of water that dripped from Galileo's timing device, by the end of 2 such instants, it would travel 4 times as far. After 3 instants, it wound up at 9 times the initial distance of descent. After 4 instants, 16 distance units. And so on, always accelerating, always arriving at a distance determined by the square of the time passed. Aristotle had ruled out any such mathematical approach to physics on the grounds that mathematicians pondered immaterial concepts, while nature consisted entirely of matter. And nature, furthermore, could not be expected to follow precise numerical rules. Galileo argued against this stance. Just as the accountant who wants his calculations to deal with sugar, silk, and wool must discount the boxes, bales, and other packings, so the mathematical scientist, when he wants to recognize in the concrete the effects he has proved in the abstract, must deduct any material hindrances such as friction or air resistance. And if he is able to do that, I assure you that things are in no less agreement than are arithmetical computations. The trouble lies, then, not in abstractness or concreteness, but with the accountant, who does not know how to balance his books. Galileo envisioned the experimental, mathematical analysis of nature as the wave of the future. There will be opened a gateway and a road to a large and excellent science, he predicted, into which minds more piercing than mine shall penetrate to recesses still deeper. While Galileo devoted his time at Siena to writing, Ambassador Niccolini in Rome tirelessly pursued his full repatriation. The Pope, however, would not be pressured into a promise, thus leaving the final sentence an open question. Rumors spoke of Galileo's possible confinement after Siena at the Certosa, a vast hilltop monastery built in the 14th century just south of Florence, where the 12 resident monks produced a locally famous wine. Such a move would bring Galileo even closer to Arcetri, facilitating the exchange of letters with his daughter while ruling out any chance of his seeing her. Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, when I wrote to you about your coming home soon, sire, or your otherwise remaining where you are for a while longer, I knew of the petition you had made to his lordship the ambassador, but was not yet aware of his answer, which I since learned from Signor Geri when he came here last Tuesday, just after I had written yet another letter to you, enclosing the formulation of the pills that by now must surely have reached you. My motive for addressing you in that seemingly distant fashion had grown out of my frequent discussions with Signor Rondinelli, who all through this period has been my refuge, because, as practical and experienced as he is in the ways of the world, he has many times alleviated my anxiety, prognosticating for me the outcome of situations concerning your affairs, especially in cases that seemed more precipitous to me than they later turned out to be. Once during those discussions, he told me how people in Florence were saying that when you departed from Siena, sire, you would have to go to the Certosa, a condition that displeased every one of your friends. Yet he saw some good in going along with those orders, as I understand the ambassador himself did too, for they both suspected that soliciting too urgently for your direct return here, sire, might bring about some negative consequence, and therefore they wanted to allow more time to elapse before entreating again. Whereupon I, fearing the worst could all too easily come to pass, and hearing you were preparing to petition yet again, set myself to write to you as I did. If ever I fail to make a great demonstration of the desire I harbor for your return, I refrain only to avoid goading you too much or disquieting you excessively. Rather than take that risk, all through these days I have been building castles in the air, thinking to myself if, after these 2 months of delay in not obtaining the favor of your release, I had been able to appeal to her ladyship the ambassadress, then she, working through the sister-in-law of His Holiness, might have successfully implored the Pope on your behalf. I know, as I freely admit to you, that these are poorly drawn plans, yet still, I would not rule out the possibility that the prayers of a pious daughter could outweigh even the protection of great personages. While I was wandering lost in these schemes, and I saw in your letter, sire, how you imply that one of the things that fans my desire for your return is the anticipation of seeing myself delighted by a certain present you are bringing, oh, I can tell you that I turned truly angry, but enraged in the way that blessed King David exhorts us in his psalm where he says, Irascimini et nolite pecare, be angry, but sin not. Because it seems almost as though you are inclined to believe, sire, that the sight of the gift might mean more to me than that of you yourself, which differs as greatly from my true feelings as the darkness from the light. It could be that I mistook the sense of your words, and with this likelihood I calm myself, because if you questioned my love, I would not know what to say or do. Enough, sire, but do realize that if you are allowed to come back here to your hovel, you could not possibly find it more derelict than it is, especially now that the time approaches to refill the casks, which, as punishment for the evil they committed in allowing the wine to spoil, have been hauled up onto the porch and there staved in according to the sentence pronounced on them by the most expert wine drinkers in these parts, who point out as the primary problem your practice, sire, of never having broken them open before, and the same experts claim the casks cannot suffer now for having had some sunshine upon their planks. I received 8 scudi from the sale of the wine, of which I spent 3 on 6 stia of wheat, so that as the weather turns cooler, La Piera may return to her bread-baking. La Piera sends her best regards to you, and says that if she were able to weigh your desire to return against her longing to see you, she feels certain her side of the scale would plummet to the depths, while yours would fly up to the sky. Of Geppo there is no news worthy of mention. Signor Ondinelli this week has paid the 6 scudi to Vincenzo Landucci and has retained 2 receipts, one for last month, one for this. I hear that Vincenzo and the children are healthy, but I do not know how they are getting along, not having been able to inquire after them from a single person. I am sending you another batch of the same pills, and I greet you with all my heart, together with our usual friends and Signor Ondinelli. May our Lord bless you. From San Matteo, the 20th day of August, 1633. Most affectionate daughter, Sua Maria Celeste. Chapter 28. Recitation of the Penitential Psalms. Galileo in Siena reconvened his 3 familiar characters, Salviati, Sagredo, and Simplicio, and let them take up the discussion of his 2 new sciences. The banning of the dialogue had destroyed his literary monument to the memory of those long-gone friends, and so, although Galileo had no idea whether he would be allowed to publish another book, he began to put his accumulated material on motion into their mouths. He composed the dialogue for the first 2 of his 3 interlocutors 4 new days together during his 5-month stay at the Archbishop's house. In the initial excitement of greeting one another again, the 3 companions flood their talk with speculations on how to measure the speed of light or the weight of air, and how patterns of waves create consonance or dissonance in music. But their voices have changed since last they met. It is as though, it must be because, all 3 have lived through Galileo's tribulations with him and lost their verve. Salviati is not as persuasive. Sagredo not as passionate, Simplicio not nearly as stubbornly opposed to novelty. In lieu of the sarcastic barbs and literary devices that animated the dialogue, the men trade polite lines to maintain the dramatic form, but not the flair of the previous book. On the 3rd and 4th days, they open their Italian dialogue to Salviati's reading aloud an entire Latin treatise on motion written by our academician, as they like to call Galileo. These sections, dense as any geometry textbook, almost immediately lose the casual reader in a forest of propositions and theorems, though they embody Galileo's seminal restructuring of physics as a science based on mathematics. Instead of Sagredo's palazzo on the Grand Canal, Galileo staged the trio's reunion at the great shipworks of the Venice Arsenale, where they could draw inspiration from the sight of men and machines at work. "The constant activity which you Venetians display in your famous arsenale," Salviati exclaims in his opening speech, "suggests to the studious mind a large field for investigation, especially that part of the work which involves mechanics." An experienced artisan at the shipyard immediately sets them off with his remark that extra care must be taken in the launching of the largest vessels so as to avoid the peril of the big ships splitting apart under their own great weight. Sagredo thinks this explanation strains belief. "Though it is proverbial and commonly accepted," he says, "that large structures are weaker than small, I hold it to be altogether false, like many another saying which is current among the ignorant." Sagredo's doubt gives Salviati a chance to reveal the wisdom of the old workman's words, supported by our friend Galileo's mathematical demonstrations regarding relative size and strength of materials, the first of the 2 new sciences in the book's title. The second, motion, including free fall and the paths of fired projectiles, would be covered on days 3 and 4. "Please observe, gentlemen," Salviati responds, "how facts which at first seem improbable will, even on scant explanation, drop the cloak which has hidden them and stand forth in naked and simple beauty. Who does not know that a horse falling from a height of 3 or 4 braccia will break his bones, while a dog falling from the same height, or a cat from 8 or 10, or even more, will suffer no injury? Equally harmless would be the fall of a grasshopper from a tower, or the fall of an ant from the distance of the moon. Do not children fall with impunity from heights which would cost their elders a broken leg, or perhaps a fractured skull? And just as smaller animals are proportionately stronger and more robust than the larger, so also smaller plants are able to stand up better than larger. I am certain you both know that an oak 200 feet high would not be able to sustain its own branches if they were distributed as in a tree of ordinary size, and that nature cannot produce a horse as large as 20 ordinary horses, or a giant 10 times taller than an ordinary man, unless, by miracle or by greatly altering the proportions of his limbs, and especially of his bones, which would have to be considerably enlarged over the ordinary. Likewise, the current belief that, in the case of artificial machines, the very large and the small are equally feasible and lasting is a manifest error." The diagrams and geometrical proofs that follow show how volume outstrips strength as things get bigger. Volume expands as the cube of body's dimensions, while strength increases only as much as their square. "I am quite satisfied," declares Simplicio toward the end of the first day, "and you may both believe me that if I were to begin my studies over again, I should try to follow the advice of Plato and commence from mathematics, which proceeds so carefully and does not admit as certain anything except what it has conclusively proved." On day 2, when the discussion becomes more mathematical and even more dependent upon diagrams, Salviati elaborates on problems of scale by drawing a couple of bones. One appears to be a femur from a dog. The other looks like a gross, bloated distortion of the same. "To illustrate briefly," Salviati says, "I have sketched a bone whose natural length has been increased 3 times and whose thickness has been multiplied until, for a correspondingly large animal, it would perform the same function which the small bone performs for its small animal. From the figures here shown, you can see how out of proportion the enlarged bone appears. Clearly, then, if one wishes to maintain in a great giant the same proportion of limb as that found in an ordinary man, he must either find a harder and stronger material for making the bones, or he must admit a diminution of strength in comparison with men of medium stature. For if his height be increased inordinately, he will fall and be crushed under his own weight. Whereas, if the size of a body be diminished, the strength of that body is not diminished in the same proportion. Indeed, the smaller the body, the greater its relative strength. Thus, a small dog could probably carry on his back 2 or 3 dogs of his own size, but I believe that a horse could not carry even 1 horse of his own size." "I am delighted to hear of your good health and peace of mind," Suor Maria Celeste wrote in response to one of Galileo's progress reports on 2 new sciences, "and that your pursuits are so well suited to your tastes, as your current writing seems to be. But, for love of God, may these new subjects not chance to meet the same luck as past ones already written." Because of the subjects he had treated in his dialogue, Galileo was now expected to perform penance as part of the process of contrition. The Holy Office had enjoined him to recite the 7 penitential psalms once a week for 3 years to aid his rehabilitation. St. Augustine, around the dawn of the 5th century, had selected these particular psalms for daily study and prayer in trying times as a way to guard and greaten one's faith. "O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. Have mercy upon me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are vexed." Psalm 6, verses 1 and 2. The sacrament of penance, which the Protestants had rejected during the Reformation, increased in importance in 17th century Italy after the Council of Trent. The penitent was required to reconcile himself with God and the Church by performing 3 kinds of acts: contrition, confession, and satisfaction. Galileo had already expressed his contrition and confessed publicly by abjuration. He most likely confessed in private and in confidence to an individual priest as well, although there is no evidence. Of necessity, there would be no evidence that he did so. Even though the council's decrees stipulated only a single confession annually at Eastertide, a new spiritual emphasis on the introspective examination of conscience compelled many Catholics to confess their sins as often as once a month. Satisfaction, the third act of the sacrament of penance, consisted in performing three classes of good works, namely prayer, fasting, and the giving of alms. The recitation of the penitential psalms, in partial fulfillment of the prayer obligation, would have taken Galileo approximately one quarter of an hour per week on his knees. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man unto whom the Lord imputeth not iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no guile. Psalm 32, verses 1 and 2. September saw the end of the plague epidemic that had menaced life in Tuscany for two whole years. Grand Duke Ferdinando attributed the respite to the May procession of the miraculous Madonna of Impruneta. He and his grandmother, Grand Duchess Christina, ordered their finest craftsmen to create ornate tokens of appreciation, including a cross in carved rock crystal with gold decorative bands, 15 silver votive vases, and a silver reliquary containing the skull of Saint Sixtus, which the Medici family sent in a grateful outpouring to the small church that housed the Virgin's holy image. I acknowledge my sin unto thee, and mine iniquity have I not hid. I said, I will confess my transgressions unto the Lord, and thou forgavest the iniquity of my sin. Psalm 32, verse 5. At the convent of San Matteo in Arcetri, the disappearance of the plague coincided with another remarkable stroke of good fortune. Through a series of deaths attributed to old age, the late brother of Suor Clarice Burci bequeathed the nuns a farm at Ambrogiana valued at more than 5,000 scudi. In reporting this event to Galileo, Suor Maria Celeste estimated the coming year's harvest to yield 120 bushels of wheat, 50 barrels of wine, and 70 sacks of millet and other grains, so that my convent will be greatly relieved. She anticipated that Galileo, too, would be relieved of constant requests for money, given the sisters' sudden affluence. Their benefactor, well knowing the nuns could not leave the convent to tend crops and feed animals, had thoughtfully willed them a full complement of field hands and caretakers to remain on the property. Along with this largesse, the poor Clares of San Matteo inherited the responsibility of celebrating Mass every day for 400 years to pray for the immortal soul of Suor Clarice's brother. They also stood obliged to perform the office for the dead in his honor three times per year for the next two centuries. To these requisite prayers, Suor Maria Celeste voluntarily added the psalms for her father's penance. Forsake me not, O Lord, O my God, be not far from me. Make haste to help me, O Lord, my salvation. Psalm 38, verses 21 and 22. Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, Saturday I wrote to you, sire, and Sunday, thanks to Signor Niccolo Gherardini, a young admirer and later biographer of Galileo, who was related to Suor Elisabetta. Your letter was delivered to me, through which, learning of the hope you hold out for your return, I am consoled, as every hour seems a thousand years to me while I await that promised day when I shall see you again. And hearing that you continue to enjoy your well-being only doubles my desire to experience the manifold happiness and satisfaction that will come from watching you return to your own home, and moreover, in good health. I would surely not want you to doubt my devotion, for at no time do I ever leave off commending you with all my soul to blessed God, because you fill my heart, sire, and nothing matters more to me than your spiritual and physical well-being. And to give you some tangible proof of this concern, I tell you that I succeeded in obtaining permission to view your sentence, the reading of which, though on the one hand it grieved me wretchedly, on the other hand it thrilled me to have seen it and found in it a means of being able to do you good, sire, in some very small way, that is, by taking upon myself the obligation you have to recite one time each week the seven psalms. And I have already begun to fulfill this requirement, and to do so with great zest, First, because I believe that prayer, accompanied by the claim of obedience to Holy Church, is effective, and then, too, to relieve you of this care. Therefore, had I been able to substitute myself in the rest of your punishment, most willingly would I elect a prison even straiter than this one in which I dwell, if by so doing I could set you at liberty. Now we have come this far, and the many favors we have already received give us hope of having still others bestowed on us, provided that our faith is accompanied by good works. For as you know better than I, sire, fides sine operibus mortua est. Faith without works is lifeless. My dear Suor Luisa continues to fare badly, and because of the pains and spasm that afflict her right side, from the shoulder to the hip, she can hardly bear to stay in bed, but sits up on a chair day and night. The doctor told me the last time he came to visit her that he suspected she had an ulcer in her kidney, and that if this were her problem it would be incurable. The worst thing of all for me is to see her suffer without being able to help her at all, because my remedies bring her no relief. Yesterday they put the funnels in the 6 barrels of rose wine, and all that remains now is to refill the cask. Signor Rondinelli was there, just as he also attended the harvesting of the grapes, and told me that the must was fermenting vigorously, so that he hoped it would turn out well, though there is not a lot of it. I do not yet know exactly how much. This is all that for now in great haste I am able to tell you. I send you loving regards on behalf of our usual friends, and pray the Lord to bless you. From San Mateo, the 3rd day of October, 1633, most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Psalm 51, verses 1, 2, and 3. It is not known whether Galileo himself recited the prayers of his penance, either before or after Suor Maria Celeste assumed the burden, for this was a duty performed in private. In public, Galileo remained ever consistent in his conviction that he had committed no crime. "I have 2 sources of perpetual comfort," he wrote retrospectively to his French supporter, Nicolas Claude Fabry de Peyresque. "First, that in my writings there cannot be found the faintest shadow of irreverence towards the Holy Church, and second, the testimony of my own conscience, which only I and God in heaven thoroughly know. And he knows that in this cause for which I suffer, though many might have spoken with more learning, none, not even the ancient fathers, have spoken with more piety or with greater zeal for the Church than I. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee. Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. They shall perish, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment. As a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. But thou art the same, and thy years shall have no end." Psalm 102, verses 1, 25, 26, and 27. Chapter 29. The Book of Life, or A Prophet Accepted in His Own Land. During this episode of anticipated healing at Siena, Galileo sank periodically into despondency. In October, he confided to his daughter that he felt as though his name had been stricken from the roll call of the living. The condemnation by the Holy Office, so far exceeding the contumely he had come to expect in reaction to his work, branded him an outcast in his own eyes. At his worst moments, he despaired of ever re-establishing his reputation, of ever bringing the rest of his work to light. All his life, he had attracted jealousy and criticism, sustaining blows dealt in such number and with such vehemence that he esteemed himself a magnet for malignity. May it please blessed God that the final decree regarding your return does not postpone it longer than we hope. Suor Maria Celeste wrote, "Write back brightly on October 15th. But meanwhile I take endless pleasure in hearing how ardently Monsignor Archbishop perseveres in loving you and favoring you. Nor do I suspect in the slightest that you are crossed out, as you say, de libro viventium, certainly not throughout most of the world, and not even in your own country. On the contrary, it seems to me from what I hear that while you may have been eclipsed or erased very briefly, now you are restored and renewed, which is a thing that stupefies me, because I am well aware that ordinarily, nemo propheta acceptus in patria sua. I fear that my wanting to use the Latin phrase has perhaps made me utter some barbarism. And surely, sire, here at the convent you are also beloved and esteemed more than ever. For all this may the Lord God be praised, as he is the principal source of these graces, which I consider my own reward, and thus I have no other desire but to show gratitude for them, so that his divine majesty may continue to concede other graces to you, sire, and to us as well, but above all, your health and eternal blessing. Everything Suor Maria Celeste intimated about Galileo's standing in the wide arena of the world was true. His former pupils still revered him, and elsewhere in Europe they spoke out against the injustice of his condemnation. His supporters included René Descartes in Holland, astronomer Pierre Gassendi, and mathematicians Marin Mersenne and Pierre de Fermat in France. The French ambassador to Rome, François de Noailles, who had studied under Galileo at Padua, campaigned for his pardon, marching into Rome in 1633 in lavish display at the head of a cavalcade of silver-shod horses attended by liverymen in gold-embroidered coats. Churchmen, too, let it be known that Galileo had been wronged, though few protested as boldly as the Archbishop of Siena. In Venice, for example, Galileo could still rely on the loyalty of Fra Fulgencio Micanzio, theologian to the Venetian Republic, whom he had met during his years in Padua. Micanzio had weathered previous papal storms, as in 1606, when Pope Paul V imposed the interdict against Venice, virtually suspending the celebration of Catholic life in that territory for a full year as a punishment for the Republic's flouting of his authority. Micanzio had stood by his former superior, Galileo's good friend, Fra Paolo Sarpi, throughout that ordeal and until Sarpi's death in 1623, when he succeeded him. Similarly, Micanzio would stand by Galileo now. The truly noteworthy attentions of Archbishop Piccolomini, meanwhile, reached well beyond the palace where Galileo remained his charge, all the way to Galileo's daughters at the convent of San Matteo in Arcetri. The Monsignor sent them frequent gifts, including his most excellent wine, which was shared among all the nuns, either by the glass or in their soup. Thanks to the Archbishop, Galileo could proffer Suor Maria Celeste treats she had never seen or imagined, such as the creamy white, egg-shaped lumps of mozzarella cheese made from water buffalo's milk. "Lord Father, I must inform you that I am a blockhead," she admitted in response to this promised gift, "indeed the biggest one in this part of Italy, because, seeing how you wrote of sending me 7 buffalo eggs, I believed them truly to be eggs, and planned to fry a huge omelet, convinced that such eggs would be very grand indeed, and in so doing I made a merry time for Suor Luisa, who laughed long and hard at my foolishness." Here she punned, by calling herself a bufala, a word meaning both blockhead and female buffalo. When she learned in a subsequent letter that Monsignor Archbishop was well aware of my gaffe regarding the buffalo eggs, I could not help but blush for shame, although, on the other hand, I am happy to have given you grounds for laughter and gladness, as it is with this motive I so often write to you of foolish things. 10 months into her wearisome separation from her father, she remained his faithful chronicler on all matters of possible interest, even when her headaches and toothaches forced her to be brief. "Signor Rondinelli," she reported in mid-October, "has not shown his face here for a fortnight, because, from what I hear, he is drowning in the little bit of wine he had put in 2 kegs that are turning bad and giving him great grief." Although Galileo never left the palace grounds, the Archbishop facilitated his affairs, enabling Suor Maria Celeste to request specific items at her whim. "I have always wanted to know how to make those Sienese cakes that everyone raves about. Now that All Saints' Day, November 1st, is approaching, you will have the occasion, sire, to let me see them. I do not say taste them, so as not to sound gluttonous. You are further obliged, because of the promise you made me, to send me some of that strong reddish linen yarn which I would like to use to start preparing some little Christmas gift for Galileino, whom I adore, because Signor Jerry tells me that, beyond being the namesake, the boy also has the spirit of his grandfather. She further urged Galileo to write two lines to his ever-concerned Dr. Giovanni Ronconi, whom she saw frequently in the infirmary these days. Suor Maria Celeste summoned Dr. Ronconi or one of his confreres to the convent whenever an illness appeared too grave for her to treat alone. "Those who are sick may lie on sacks filled with straw and may have feather pillows for their heads, and those who need woolen socks and mattresses may use them." The Rule of St. Clair, Chapter 8. Although the danger of the plague had passed, fevers and persistent malaises now afflicted five of the nuns. Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, last Wednesday, a brother of the Priory of San Firenze came to bring me a letter from you along with a little package of russet linen yarn which, considering the rather thick quality of the thread, seems somewhat expensive. But indeed the color of the dye, being very beautiful, makes the price of 6 crazzi per skein appear more tolerable. Suor Luisa stays in bed with only the slightest improvement. And in addition to her, several of the others are also sick, so that if we now faced any suspicion of plague, we would be lost. Among the sick is Suor Caterina Angela Anselmi, who was formerly our Mother Abbess, a truly venerable and prudent nun, and, after Suor Luisa, the dearest and most intimate friend I have ever had. She is so gravely ill that yesterday morning she received the extreme unction, and it appears that she has only a few days to live. And the same must be said for Suor Maria Silvia Boscoli, a young woman of 22 years, and you may recall, sire, how people once spoke of her as the most beautiful girl to grace the city of Florence for 300 years. This marks the 6th month she has been lying in bed with a continuous fever that the doctors now say has turned to consumption. And she is so wasted as to be unrecognizable. Yet with all that, she retains a vivacity and energy, especially in her speech, that astounds us, while from hour to hour we doubt whether that faint spirit, which seems entirely confined to her tongue, will fade away and abandon the already exhausted body. Then, too, she is so listless that we can find no nourishment to suit her taste, or to say it better, that her stomach can accept, except a little soup made from broth, in which we have boiled some dried wild asparagus, and these are extremely difficult to find at this time of year, wherefore I was thinking that perhaps she could take some soup made from grey partridge, which has no gamey taste. And since these birds abound where you are, sire, as you say in your letters, you might be able to send me one of them for her and for Suor Luisa, and I doubt you would encounter any difficulty having them reach me in good condition, since our Suor Maria Maddalena Squadrini recently received several fresh good thrushes that were sent by a brother of hers, who is prior at the Monastery of the Angels, in a part of the diocese very close to Siena. If, without too much trouble, sire, you could help me make such a gift, now that the idea has whetted my appetite, I would be ever so grateful. This time it devolves upon me to play the raven who bears bad tidings. As I must tell you, that on the feast day of San Francesco, October 4th, Goro, who worked for the Certinis, died and left a family in great distress. According to his wife, who was here yesterday morning to beseech me that I must convey this news to you, sire, and furthermore remind you of the promise you made to Goro himself and to Antonia, his daughter, to give her a black woolen house dress when she got married. Now they are in dire straits, and Sunday, which will be tomorrow, she will say her vows in church. And because Goro's wife has spent what little money she had, first on medicaments and then for his funeral, she is hard-pressed, and wants to know if you can do her this kindness. I promised that I would tell her your answer as soon as I heard from you, sire. I would not know how to make you realize the happiness I derive from learning that you continue conserving your health in spite of everything, except to say that I enjoy your good fortune more than my own, not only because I love you more than myself, but also because I can imagine that if I were oppressed by infirmity or otherwise removed from the world, it would matter little or nothing to anyone, since I am good for little or nothing, whereas in your case, sire, the opposite holds true for a host of reasons, but especially, beyond the fact that you do so much good and are able to help so many others, because the great intellect and knowledge that the Lord God has given you enables you to serve Him and honor Him far more than I ever could, so that with this consideration I come round to cheer myself and take greater pleasure from your well-being than from mine. Signor Rondinelli has allowed himself to be seen again now that his kegs have quieted down. He sends his greetings to you, sire, and so does Dr. Ronconi. I assure you that I am never vexed by boredom, sire, but sooner by the hunger caused, I believe, if not by all the exercise I perform, then by the coldness of my stomach, which does not get the full complement of sleep it requires, since I have no time. I rely on the oxymele and the papal pills to make up this deficit. I only tell you this to excuse myself for the haphazard appearance of my letter, as I was compelled to put down and then take up my pen again more than once before I could complete it. And, on that note, I commend you to God. From San Matteo, in Arcetri, the 22nd day of October, 1633. Your most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. The enclosed conforms to the wish you expressed in your previous letter, sire, that after having written to you, I should write also to her ladyship the ambassadress. I suspect that my numerous activities have sapped my energy, leaving me little to give her. You will be able to look it over and make corrections, and do let me know if you send her the ivory crucifix. I still cling to the hope that this week you will have some resolution regarding your release, and I am burning with desire to share in that news. According to medieval and Renaissance medical theory, each of the earth's four elements, earth, fire, air, water, had its correspondent humor in the human body, black bile, yellow bile, blood, phlegm. These, in turn, denoted specific organs, spleen, liver, heart, brain, and conveyed the qualities respectively of dry cold, dry heat, and moist cold. Suor Maria Celeste spoke in diagnostic terms when she referred to the coldness of her stomach, meaning that it behaved sluggishly. Foods, remedies, and common activities could likewise be classified and prescribed by the same four qualities, so that the asparagus offered in broth to the once lovely Suor Maria Silvia was described by herbalists as warm and moist in the first degree. Partridges, being of moderate warmth, were recommended for convalescence. Dr. Ronconi, with a university education in natural philosophy and more options at his disposal, could purge or bleed patients as necessary to restore the body's balance. Being a physician gave him higher social status than the so-called barber surgeons, most of whom received vocational training outside the university setting. The same disdain also tainted surgeons from the finest schools. Galileo viewed the snobbishness shown by physicians towards surgeons as the same sort of groundless prejudice that philosophers lorded over mathematicians. Having befriended and benefited from the ministrations of the famed anatomist Girolamo Fabrici of Acqua Pendente, Galileo used him to make a point in defense of geometry. I hear my adversaries shouting in my ears that it is one thing to deal with matters physically and quite another to do so mathematically, and that geometers should stick to their fantasies and not get entangled in philosophical matters, as if truth could ever be more than one, as if geometry up to our time had prejudiced the acquisition of true philosophy, as if it were impossible to be a geometer as well as a philosopher. And we must infer as a necessary consequence that anyone who knows geometry cannot know physics, and cannot reason about and deal with physical matters physically. Consequences no less foolish than that of a certain physician who, moved by a fit of spleen, said that the great Dr. Acqua Pendente, being a famed anatomist and surgeon, should content himself to remain among his scalpels and ointments without trying to effect cures by medicine, as if knowledge of surgery destroyed and opposed a knowledge of medicine. I replied to him that having many times recovered my health through the supreme excellence of Signor Acquapendente, I could depose and certify that he had never given me to drink any compound of cerates, caustics, threads, bandages, probes, and razors, nor had he ever, instead of feeling my pulse, cauterized me or pulled a tooth from my mouth. Rather, as an excellent physician, he purged me with manna, cassia, or rhubarb, and used other remedies suitable to my ailments. Well acquainted with her father's ailments, Suor Maria Celeste regularly sent him her handmade papal pills, which contained dried rhubarb, a natural laxative, saffron supplied from Siena by Galileo, and aloe that had been washed with rose water no fewer than 7 times. Her sluggish digestive system relied on the same medicine, although she took less care in preparing her own pills, leaving out whatever she lacked at the moment and settling for a single rosewater washing of the aloe. When caring for Arcangela or another sick sister, however, she asked Galileo's help in procuring expensive ingredients such as tetuccio water, a superior purgative, and nutmeg oil to control nausea and vomiting. Such substances, catalogued in the official Florentine pharmacopoeia, could be formulated into pills, potions, or powders following the instructions in available medical manuals. Suor Maria Celeste probably received her apprenticeship as an apothecary under the nuns and visiting doctors who staffed the convent's infirmary. Her more basic schooling in letters and Latin, on the other hand, undoubtedly came from her father in whatever time he could spare during her formative years, for it is clear that no one at San Mateo surpassed her in language skills. Even the abbesses sought her out to write important letters of official business. In Galileo's own scientific correspondence, through the autumn of 1633, he circulated among his friends certain proofs relating to the strength of materials. With their permission and to their delight, he incorporated some of their additions and suggestions into the text for the second day of Two New Sciences. Galileo would later judge Two New Sciences superior to everything else of mine hitherto published, because its pages contain results which I consider the most important of all my studies. By his own reckoning, then, his conclusions on resistance and motion outweighed all the astronomical discoveries that immortalized his name. Surely Galileo prided himself on having been the first to build a proper telescope and point it toward the sky. But he believed his own greater genius lay in his ability to observe the world at hand, to understand the behavior of its parts, and to describe these in terms of mathematical proportions. While he worked on the dialogue for the beginning of Two New Sciences, Galileo also wrote a play. He sent it to Suor Maria Celeste for performance by the nuns, apparently for the anticipated entertainment of her ladyship Caterina Nicolini, the wife of the Tuscan ambassador, who was still intent on visiting the convent. Unfortunately, nothing survives of Galileo's religious drama except his daughter's mention of it in thanks. "The play, coming from you," she wrote after reading the first act, "can be nothing if not wonderful." In Rome, Ambassador Nicolini told Urban VIII that Galileo had proved himself a model prisoner in Siena by demonstrating obedience to the Pope and the Holy Office. Urban weighed this claim against impeachments of Archbishop Piccolomini that reached him from clerics in Siena. It seemed that the archbishop quite often invited various scholars to his table, the better to enrich the intellectual repartee so beneficial to Signor Galilei's peace of mind. In other words, instead of holding Galileo prisoner as a confessed heretic, Piccolomini indulged him as a guest of honor. "The archbishop, an anonymous hand," informed officials in Rome, "has told many that Galileo was unjustly sentenced by this holy congregation, that he is the first man in the world, that he will live forever in his writings, even if they are prohibited, and that he is followed by all the best modern minds. And since such seeds sown by a prelate might bear pernicious fruit, I hereby report them." Chapter 30. My Soul and Its Longing. It rained all across Tuscany through the end of October 1633 and on into November. The dampness aggravated Galileo's arthritic pains, deepened Suor Maria Celeste's lassitude, cast its dreary pall over all their expectations. Suor Caterina Angela, the former mother abbess at San Mateo, died in the wet autumn weather, and the nuns buried her in the convent cemetery in the rain. "I am the resurrection, I am the life. He who believes in me, even if he dies, shall live, and whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." Office for the Dead, Canticle of Zechariah. The other sick nuns in the infirmary held on. Galileo failed to send the partridge for them, though not through lack of trying. This late in the hunting season, not a single one could be bagged anywhere. Sua Maria Celeste, for her part, had no better luck procuring the tiny ortolan buntings that Galileo craved and could not get in Siena. "I delayed writing this week," she apologized, "because I really wanted to send you the ortolan."